weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I.
And I'm Jeff Frame, a teaching associate professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences here at the U of I.
Each week, this podcast will bring together some of the world's experts on weather and climate to explain the science behind what's happening. And we want to hear from you. If you have a weather or climate question you want answered, please leave a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. For those who aren't aware exactly what the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences does, Jeff, can you talk a little bit about what happens in the department?
We teach our undergraduate majors in a variety of courses from the introductory all the way up to the graduate level. And we perform research in all areas of atmospheric sciences, meteorology, and climate, including severe weather, how clouds form, how sunlight gets through the atmosphere, and climate change, and potential impacts.
Awesome. And then within that department, what do you focus on specifically in your research?
I mainly teach. I teach three courses per semester, plus a field course over the summer in which I take students out to forecast and observe thunderstorms out on the Great Plains. And in terms of research, I work on severe weather and weather forecasting.
During the first half of our show, Jeff Frame and I will be talking about the July 4th flash flooding event in Kerrville, Texas, and emergency management risk communication.
Tonight, the death toll from the Central Texas floods is now at least 131 people. Officials worry it could be more than double that amount, with little to no rescue since last week.
I don't want to say I accepted it, but no, I thought I was going to die.
Leo Romero never went to sleep the night of July 3rd.
You know, I was awake all night playing just like, you know, games.
Around 6 a.m. on July 4th, he heard the water. His father told Leo and his stepmother, Natalia, to climb onto the couch, grab the curtains. Leo Sr. held his toddler son in the air.
How I recall it is the roof fell, but, you know, just next thing I know, house is gone, so I'm just in the water.
When I woke up at 3:30, the water was already in my RV and sweeping everybody downstream.
He remembers the screams, the people begging for help.
Flung my hand up and my neighbor grabbed me and pulled me out.
I want to ask you if you can describe the hill country of Texas and tell us why it's so prone to flash flooding events.
Sure. The hill country, as you might imagine from its name, is a hilly area roughly near the geographic center of Texas, so a bit west of Austin, west and northwest of San Antonio. And it is characterized by fairly steep rocky topography. Some of the hills can be 100 feet or more above some of the river valleys. And so these river valleys are relatively deep. And when we combine this with the rocky and the clay soils that are in place there, well, it takes a long time for water, rain, to soak into clay soil. So what happens is you get rapid runoff downhill into the Guadalupe and of other rivers. And also that river and the rivers there have not been dammed, so there are no artificial flood control systems in that watershed.
So listeners in Illinois might hear 7 inches of rain in the forecast and not be too concerned. What makes the impacts of this amount of rain so different in the hill country than what it would be in Illinois?
Well, if you hear 7 inches of rain in the forecast, especially over a short period of time, but even over a week, you should be concerned. But I'll talk about how impacts might be a little bit different here due to our different geology and geography than the hill country of Texas. And in that event back on July 4th, Some areas not only got 6 or 7 inches of rain, but some areas got up to 12 or 15 inches of rain falling in only a few hours. And that's going to yield devastating flooding just about anywhere. But the exact impacts and the timetable at which the disaster might happen could differ. So, for example, here in central Illinois, it's obviously much flatter. We don't have a hill country here in central Illinois. And so just like if you have a flat table and you pour some water out on that table, well, that water is just going to sit there. It's not really going to go anywhere all that quickly. And so the same thing would happen here if we have heavy rain over some localized area happening in a few to several hours. Well, that rain, it'll run into some of the lower areas, right? Some little runs and streams you see out in the farm fields. But really, that water is going to sit around for a lot longer. And it will also take a lot longer for the water to go down here, simply because, again, it's going to run off much slower than it did down in the hill country of Texas. With the Texas flood, yeah, we had the devastation that night into the early morning hours of July 4th, but they were able to evacuate people out of those camps on July 4th. Mm-hmm. The river had already gone down a substantial amount, and we'll get to the timetable in a second. So that means here in Illinois, we're not going to have a 20-foot wall of water sweeping down a river valley in an hour. That's not going to happen here. Now, not all of central Illinois' flat farms. Some of it we have urban areas like Champaign-Urbana, Bloomington-Normal, Springfield, and so forth. Heavy rain over urban areas, even, you know, less than that 7 inches of rain you heard about, can very quickly overwhelm drainage systems. So if you're familiar with Champaign here, for example, South Neal Street over by the Ribeye restaurant, every time, you know, we get maybe more than an inch of rain in a thunderstorm, we start to experience minor street flooding on that side of town. Now, some of the smaller streams, like, for example, near Villa Grove in southern Champaign County, Gibson City up in Ford County to the north, those can experience more rapid rises there. And we've seen flooding again, especially near some of those smaller streams here in central Illinois. And then we get to our larger river systems like the Wabash, the Illinois, or the Mississippi rivers. When those flood, that's what we call a widespread flood, where that requires heavy rain, usually over a period of several days, if not weeks. And that is a lot easier to forecast because, right, the rain has, or the water takes time to flow through the hydrologic system and flow downstream. So we can get people out of the way, but there tends to be a lot more property damage with those events because they affect a much larger area. And of course, you can't get houses and buildings and so forth out of the way.
Interesting. And there was also some recent flooding in Chicago that was kind of an extreme flash flooding event. Is that kind of a similar situation where because you have so much concrete, the water can build up a lot faster?
Yes. Yeah. Up in Chicago, yeah, that would just be a bigger version of like Champaign-Urbana in terms of the urban built-up environment.
For those just tuning in, this is Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I. Today, I'm talking with Jeff Frame, teaching associate professor at the University of Illinois in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Science, about the July 4th Kerrville, Texas flash flooding event. How do the storms responsible for flooding over the Guadalupe River form?
Yeah, so the weather pattern was not atypical for midsummer down in central Texas. There was a weak area of mid-level low pressure, or an upper-level disturbance, you could call it. Now, I'll throw a technical term out here. It's called a mesoscale convective vortex, or MCV for short. And those form out of complexes of storms from the previous day. So mesoscale just means it's on the scale of 10 to 100 miles or so across. Convective means, well, it's originating in thunderstorms. Thunderstorms are a form of convection in the atmosphere. Warm, less dense air rises up through the air. And then a vortex is just a closed circulation. And then we're combining this mid-level disturbance with a lot of rich tropical moisture from Tropical Storm Barry. That hit made landfall in Mexico a couple days before the flooding disaster. And obviously, tropical systems bring rich, deep moisture from the tropics with them. And so when you combine lift from that mid-level disturbance with
moisture... So lift moisture, would just be warm air rising.
Yeah, lift is just air rising. Air goes up. And when air goes up and you have moisture, you get clouds and you get rain. And if you have a lot of moisture, you get a lot of rain. And if the winds in the atmosphere are weak, well, whatever's making a lot of rain isn't going to move very fast, and it will continue to drop heavy rain over the same areas, leading to flooding.
So another side of natural disaster preparedness is risk communication. This is still an active area of research in behavioral and social science, but there is some research to support that, especially for weather events with longer lead times, like heat waves and hurricanes, risk communication, not the lead time on the science side, is where early warning systems are falling short. Can you take us through both the weather events of July 3rd and 4th that caused this flash flooding event in Texas and the response timeline?
Yeah, sure. This event was about as well forecast as an event like this could be. So the flooding hit in the early morning hours of July 4th, the 4th of July, Independence Day. So middle of the night, leading into a holiday. If you want to try to find the worst possible time for a disaster like this, along a river that is populated with a dozen summer camps and other RV camps for the public, I don't think you could get a much worse time than this. So, for example, we have research that says tornadoes that strike at night are twice as deadly on average as tornadoes that strike during the day. There's nothing meteorologically that makes them more dangerous at night. It's just that a lot of people are asleep. And if somebody's asleep and they can't get the warning and a tornado hits, they're in a much more vulnerable position. And same thing happens with flooding at night as well. But now let's go through that timeline. All right. So at 1:18 p.m. on July 3rd, so the day before the flood, the National Weather Service issued a flood watch for the affected area, calling for 5 to 7 inches of rain. At this point, the Guadalupe River was at 0.3 feet, well under flood stage, as measured at the local gauge in Kerrville, Texas. Then heavy showers and thunderstorms developed that evening and produced heavy rain that evening into the early morning hours past midnight there, going into the 4th of July. This prompted the National Weather Service at 1:14 a.m. to issue a flash flood warning. For the affected area, the river at this point had only risen to 0.8 feet. So at this point, flooding was not being measured at least by that river gauge. Then at 4:03 a.m., that warning was upgraded to what is called a flash flood emergency. And that is the strongest worded flood statement that the Weather Service can issue. And I do want to point out that even though there have been some cuts and early retirements in the National Weather Service. That office down in Austin and San Antonio was fully staffed that night. On a usual quiet night, they would have two forecasters working. But because of the flooding threat, they actually had five, which meant three people were called in to do overtime. So now back to the river levels. So around the time that flash flood emergency was issued, the river had risen to 1.7 feet. That was at 3:45 in the morning. By 4:45, 1 hour later, the river had risen to 23.4 feet. So we're talking about 20-foot-plus rise in an hour, and it probably went higher than that because then the gauge was knocked out for 3 hours. At times, reports from some of the camps and other folks along the river had the river rising at 1 foot per minute. So imagine you're down in your river house, you're looking down on the river. Let's imagine it's daylight for a second, 15 feet below you. All right. In an hour, that river is now 5 feet over your head and your house is being inundated. Where you think, oh, 15 feet, I have a lot of space here. And then for some of the kids in those summer camps, again, a dozen of them, Camp Mystic, I know, has made a lot of the news with the tragedy that happened there. Now, some camps were able to evacuate folks. But now imagine, right, you're an 8-year-old kid and you're being woken up by flooding. It's the middle of the night. And then on top of this, you have frequent lightning and loud thunder, which when I was 8-year-old, I'll admit, I was scared of thunderstorms at night, not for the flooding, but the lightning and the tornadoes and all of that.
Absolutely. And can you give us a sense of how fast this water would have been moving?
Yeah, it was not moving slowly. Certainly, it wasn't a lazy river that you might see in an amusement park, but it was moving, you know, probably at, you know, many feet per second. And it wasn't clear water either. There was a lot of mud and dirt and runoff in there. And of course, trees, sometimes entire houses or remains of houses. Once the house goes in the river, they do tend to collapse under their own weight. And cars and all kinds of debris flowing down here. And it's still raining hard. So just a terrible tragedy that unfolded there.
And we also for context, which is helpful, the water is extremely heavy. Like if you go and pick up a bucket of water, that's going to be relatively hard to lift. So if you think about, you know, 20 feet of water, that's a lot of force behind that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Just pick up a gallon of milk.
Yeah.
Right? That's heavy. And actually, if you take a cubic yard or a cubic meter of water, that actually weighs 1,000 kilograms or 2,200 pounds or a ton. So if you think about, you know, you drive your car and you end up with water outside your car and you won't be able to open that door against the force of the water until the water comes in the car, in which case, well, then there's another problem that you can't breathe in water. And so that's why over half of flash flooding fatalities in the United States occur in automobiles.
Yes, that's why the National Weather Service flooding emergency says to turn away from the direction of the water. People will kind of hop in their car and think that, oh, I can drive fast. I can kind of outrun this. But the speed of the water is just rising too high.
It's turn around, don't drown. Or if you have water flowing across the road, it can actually erode the roadway from underneath. And now that road can no longer support your car, or you think the water is a lot shallower than it really is. So basically, don't drive through water if you don't know how deep it is. Now, this was not the problem here in Texas, especially with these summer camps. This was not the issue.
Yeah. And from the National Weather Service in Lincoln, Illinois, in 2015, 14 people died as a result of driving across flooded roads, 11 of whom perished during the major flood of late December 2015. So this is the highest annual number of flood fatalities since flood records have been kept. So this is also an issue in Illinois as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Anywhere there's flooding, you do not want to drive into a flooded roadway in a car, in an SUV, in a truck, bus. I don't care what it is. Don't do it.
This is Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I.
And I'm Jeff Frame, a teaching associate professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences here at the U of I.
Each week, this podcast will bring together some of the world's experts on weather and climate to explain the science behind what's happening. And we want to hear from you. If you have a weather or climate question you want answered, please leave a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. And here to tell us about how emergency warnings work for events like flash flooding is John Dwyer, coordinator for Champaign County Emergency Management Agency. John, thank you for talking with us today.
We have a weather service office here in Lincoln, Illinois. So they would put out alerts such as, you know, a watch for flooding, a warning, an emergency warning. When they do the emergency warning or even the flash flood warning, that will often trigger a wireless emergency alert on people's phones. Your phones have to be enabled to receive those alerts. You can turn them off. It's not suggested you do. But we also stress that people have a NOAA all hazards weather alert radio to receive alerts. People need to have multiple ways to get alerts. So that don't just rely on your phone, rely on, you know, knowing ahead of time what the news is saying or having an all hazards weather alert radio. I know there's some talk in Texas from people saying they didn't get certain alerts at certain times. So it'd be interesting to know that how alerts went out and if people had the right mechanisms to receive those alerts.
So I want to go back to, you talked about you guys, your office will get warnings from the National Weather Service. And then sort of once you have those weather warnings, how do you construct warnings for the public?
Well, we have an outdoor warning siren for tornadoes as well as thunderstorms that have destructive connotation to them. So we do have an outdoor warning siren system, but those are for people that their outdoor warning sirens are for people that are outdoors. The Weather Service, like I said, when they issue a tornado warning or a flash flood warning, that will normally automatically generate a wireless emergency alert. We also will send out alerts to our community partners when there's a watch or a warning or emergency. And people, folks can sign up for a free service to get watches and warning information through the Sheriff's Office app. It's free to download. That's one thing I forgot to mention with emergency management. Here in this county, we fall under the Sheriff's Office. We're not uniformed officers, but we are employees of the Sheriff's Office. So we push out alerts through our media as much as possible, as quickly as we can. But once again, we encourage people to have multiple ways of getting alerts.
All right. And John, this is Jeff Frame here with the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. And now, could you tell me a little bit about what happens after a disaster has struck? What is the process of assessing the needs of those who have been affected and coordinating that response?
We have designated liaisons in various communities across the county, and they will let us know, you know, what damages they have, you know, say from a tornado or from floods. And then we can also send out damage assessment teams to go identify the hardest hit areas. And then from that, we can send that to the state, which will then in turn determine whether or not they send that to the feds for a disaster declaration. But we can also do a local disaster declaration to assist our partners, as well as open up the channels to get state assistance should we need it. Our biggest issue after the disaster, of course, is debris removal, especially after the tornado in Gifford, and as well as short-term needs from citizens, you know, whether it's food, shelter, clothing, those kind of things. And we can mobilize non-government agencies to help meet those short-term needs. We did that in Gifford where the Red Cross opened a MARC, which stands for a multi-agency resource center. And that center is there to let this, to have the survivors go through or those that are affected by the disaster to get, you know, maybe it's quick assistance for a shelter or quick assistance for food, or what if their driver's license was lost in a tornado? It's a real all hands on deck to see what kind of needs they have and try to supply those for the short term. St. Joe had a flood several years ago, and we worked with the Red Cross, and they sent out teams to help them. Gave out free muck-up kits where people could clean up, get supplies to clean up their homes and things like that. So we try to mobilize resources to help those that are affected.
If anything, is there something that's unique about the response to flash flooding in particular? Are there certain things to prioritize over others?
Well, like Jeff was saying, if there are barricades, are not something to drive around. If roads are cleared off or closed off, don't drive around them. But flooding after flood, take pictures, especially for your insurance. But also be aware that you don't necessarily know what's floating in the water or what's in the water. We'll try to stay out of it, but document where the flood waters were in your home. Hopefully your insurance company will work with you. And that's the other thing, is make sure that you have multiple copies of your insurance policies. You know, it's always good to have a thumb drive or some kind of storage device. Make sure it's password protected, with copies of marriage license, insurance policies, medical records for yourself, your family, your pets, things like that. Important papers, you know, military discharge papers, have a way of accessing those files if the originals happen to get lost.
Yeah, it's good to know that there are so many groups with kind of different strengths and helping in that response. John, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. This is your first time co-hosting. You did great.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It was great to be here, Maddie, and hopefully I was able to demystify some of what happened down with the Texas flooding event.
Why is it so difficult to predict a flash flood? Coming up next, learn why the term 1-in-500-year flood may give us a false sense of relief. Plus, how can one flood event devastate an entire harvest? Illinois State climatologist Trent Ford joins me next to answer these questions. I'm Maddie Stover, and you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media.